it's fighting for something that we should have gotten a long time ago, but never gotten. It's so much more than just protesting and posting. It's fighting for what we need as people to survive.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot! Don't shoot!
After 2 hours of marching through the streets, the group spread out across a baseball diamond to hear a prayer, a song, and a speech, all demanding action. A woman in the audience held up a large rainbow flag with BLM written in bold letters. Finally, the whole park fell silent as everyone went down on one knee for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, the same amount of time that the Minneapolis police officer knelt on George Floyd's neck, causing his death. When the event was over, I spoke with Jalay Knowles, one of the featured speakers.
The Black Lives Matter movement means the world to me right now, especially because of I feel as if enough is enough. Enough has been enough, but now our momentum has changed and people are speaking up. And what this movement's different right now, because I believe there's more people who are advocating, more people who are willing to educate themselves, more people who are willing to listen, and we're forming allyship. And for me personally, my main focus in this is our youth, our kids. I work with kids at Roseville Elementary School here in Ossining, and I absolutely adore them, and I want a better future for them because they ask me questions about this. I want to tell them that their future is going to be better. And I am just so passionate about how we need equity right now. We need help.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. As the Republican Party's convention kicked off, Donald Trump used the moment to yet again tout the false claim that voting by mail will cause massive fraud. This, as Trump appointee Louis DeJoy, the Postmaster General, in his appearance before the House Oversight Committee, had difficulty answering basic questions about the post office and claimed that he had nothing to do with the alarming slowdowns and cutbacks in postal service. But the Republican Party has long sought to privatize the U.S. Postal Service. Meanwhile, some progressives see some solutions to solving what is admittedly a fiscal crisis faced by the post office, including postal banking. Our guest is Christopher Shaw, author of Money, Power, and the People, The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic and Preserving the People's Post Office. And while Democrats claim the importance of the vote of suburban women, many of whom are mothers and or caring for elderly family members, what policies are they proposing to assist caregivers? How much is the work of unpaid caregivers worth? And should now unpaid caregivers receive a wage? Our guests are Peggy O'Mara, who is the editor and publisher of Mothering Magazine for over 30 years, and Catherine Myers, executive director of the Family and Home Network. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. President Trump made a surprise in-person appearance at the Republican National Convention in Charlottesville, North Carolina, and two videotaped appearances. He told the 336 delegates who formally nominated him as the Republican presidential candidate that the only way Democrats can win is if the election is rigged.
We're going to win this election. The only way they can take this election away from us is if this is a rigged election. Right. We're going to win this election.
Right.
We're going to win this election.
Presidential son Donald Trump Jr. was among those warning about a dire future should Joe Biden win the presidency.
Joe Biden and the radical left are now coming for our freedom of speech. They want to bully us into submission. If they get their way, it will no longer be the silent majority. It will be the silenced majority.
Tonight's proceedings will feature speeches by Melania Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The father of Jacob Blake, who was shot multiple times in the back by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin, says his son was left paralyzed from the waist down. Blake's father told the Chicago Sun-Times he was told the son was shot 8 times during the Sunday evening confrontation with police, which was captured on cell phone video. He said his son has 8 holes in his body and doctors don't know if the paralysis will be permanent. Anger over the shooting of yet another black man by police spilled into the streets of Kenosha for a second night despite an overnight curfew. The National Guard was called out to the streets. Police fired tear gas at hundreds of protesters who threw bottles and shot off fireworks at law enforcement guarding the courthouse. They also broke into stores and set fires. The shooting drew condemnation from the state's Democratic Governor Tony Evers and from Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes.
And let me be clear, this was not an accident. This wasn't bad police work. This felt like some sort of vendetta being taken out on a member of our community. The officer's deadly actions attempted to take a person's life in broad daylight.
Cell phone footage of police shooting Blake, apparently in the back as he leaned into his SUV while his 3 children sat in the vehicle, have circulated widely on social media. The tropical storm bearing down on the Gulf Coast gained strength and hurricane status shortly after moving over the warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico. Hurricane Laura is expected to continue intensifying on a path to hit the U.S. coastline late tomorrow or early Thursday as a major Category 3 hurricane capable of devastating damage. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards warned state residents about what's in store for them.
It's forecasted now that they can expect 7 to 11 feet of storm surge. 7 to 11 feet of storm surge. That's a big number.
Laura already killed at least 11 people in the Dominican Republic and Haiti. Higher sea surface temperatures are one of the products of climate change that makes hurricanes more intense and more deadly. Reinforcements from 8 other states and the weather are helping weary firefighters gain some ground on the 3 major blazes burning in the San Francisco Bay Area. Altogether, they've burned more than 1,200 square miles. The siege of wildfires in California has been astonishing and sobering, especially since the state's peak fire season normally is during the hot, windy days of September and October. California Governor Gavin Newsom laid out the scope of the challenge of fires burning up and down the state. More than 600 fires, 17 of them major blazes.
We're currently battling some 625 fires across the state. Sadly, we've lost 7 lives so far to these latest fires and over 1,200 reported structures. And I want to just make point, that's the number of structures that have been reported in to our Office of Emergency Services. There's no question there are more structures that have been damaged by this historic wildfire season.
Climate scientists have explained California's increasingly catastrophic fires by noting the state is 2 to 3 degrees hotter than it would have been without global warming. Food and Drug Administration Chief Stephen Hahn is admitting he overstated the benefits of convalescent plasma when he announced the FDA was granting emergency authorization for its use as a treatment for COVID-19. President Trump announced the treatment on the eve of the Republican National Convention after criticizing the FDA for not moving fast enough. The FDA chief said in a tweet last night, quote, "I have been criticized for remarks I made Sunday night about the benefits of convalescent plasma. The criticism is entirely justified. What I should have said better is the data show a relative risk reduction, not an absolute risk reduction." Outside scientists were highly critical of the FDA for not conducting double-blind and controlled studies and said Hahn misrepresented the benefits of the use of the treatment. I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. On Monday, August 24th, Donald Trump yet again attacked the U.S. Postal Service, this time while speaking at the Republican National Convention. Trump repeated his false claims about mail-in voting being fraudulent in favor of his Democratic rival, presidential candidate Joe Biden? Well, it's a mixed bag on that, because many are saying that mail-in voting may actually help Trump, but we'll see. While speaking, Donald Trump said this is the greatest scam in the history of politics. With the presidential election just weeks away, Donald Trump is continuing to attack mail-in voting and the U.S. Postal Service in his bid to stay in office. Election commissioners across the country are encouraging people to vote early and by mail in order to protect voters and poll workers from COVID-19. Trump, however, has been trying to undermine the mail-in voting process by floating unsubstantiated claims that it will be rigged in favor of the Democrats. On Monday, August 24th, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, who was appointed by Trump, testified before the Democratic-led House Oversight Committee. He was questioned about the wave of delays and questionable changes he has spearheaded within the U.S. Postal Service over the past few months. As in his Friday testimony before a Senate committee, DeJoy on Monday admitted that delays had occurred, but tried to distance himself from responsibility for cost-cutting measures. These include charging overtime rules, taking sorting machines offline, and eliminating blue drop-off boxes. DeJoy claimed he had since suspended those moves in response to public anger, considering that these measures would all impact voting in the upcoming presidential and Senate elections. Although he said he had nothing to do with those measures, he also said he will not be reversing any of the changes that have already taken place. Furthermore, he has not given Congress any legitimate plan as to how he will make sure that the U.S. Postal Service will indeed deliver people's ballots securely and on time. Earlier in the week, House Democrats passed a bill that would give $25 billion to the U.S. Postal Service and prevent changes in service until at least the end of the year. Republicans, however, are largely opposed, citing DeJoy's claims that the institution has enough money, and of course, the Senate isn't even in session. They are on vacation. Let us go to a clip now of questioning by Congresswoman Katie Porter of the Postmaster General.
Mr. DeJoy, thank you for being with us today. What is the cost of a first-class postage stamp?
55 cents.
Just wanted to check. What about to mail a postcard?
I don't know, ma'am.
You don't know the cost to mail a postcard?
I don't.
What if I want to mail you said 55 cents for a first class stamp, but what if it's like one of those greeting cards, it's a square envelope, then what is the postage?
I'll submit that I know very little about a postage stamp.
What is the weight limit? You are more in the shipping logistics business. What's the weight limit for priority mail?
70 pounds.
And what is the starting rate for U.S. Post Office, USPS priority mail?
The starting rate for what?
USPS priority mail.
Starting weight, 14 ounces.
No, the rate, the price.
I don't know. I don't know.
Do you know about within a million or so, can you tell me how many people voted by mail in the last presidential election?
No, I cannot.
To the nearest 10 million? Is that a no, Mr. DeJoy?
I would be guessing, and I don't want to guess.
Okay, so Mr. DeJoy, I'm concerned. I'm glad you know the price of a stamp. But I'm concerned about your understanding of this agency. And I'm particularly concerned about it because you started taking very decisive action when you became Postmaster General. You started directing the unplugging and destroying of machines, changing of employee procedures, and locking of collection boxes. As a professor, I've always told my students that one of the most important rules in life is to read the instructions. Did you actually read and independently analyze the major overhaul plans before you ordered them to take effect?
Again, I will repeat that I did not order major overhaul plans. The items you identify were not directed by me. I did, and
we're
we don't need much
time,
analysis to run
Could
your
you
trucks to a schedule.
Reclaiming my time, Mr. Joy, could you please tell me who did order these changes if U.S. Postmaster General did not? Because these changes have resulted in, and you have said yourself in this hearing.
The Postal Service has been around for 250 years. There are plans. There are many, many executives, almost 30,000 executives within the organization. And there are plans that existed prior to my arrival that were continued, that were implemented.
Mr. DeJoy, if you did not order these actions to be taken, please tell the committee the name of who did.
I do not know.
All righty, tough questioning there by Congresswoman Katie Porter of the Postmaster General. I'd like now to welcome our guest, Christopher W. Shaw, is the author of Money, Power, and the People, The American Struggle to Make Banking Democratic and Preserving the People's Post Office. Christopher Shaw, welcome.
Good to be here.
All righty. Now, let's start out here. Is the post office in a fiscal crisis in your view? And if so, why?
The Postal Service does have financial problems, and these largely stem from a law that was enacted in 2006 that requires it to pre-fund its retiree health benefits 75 years into the future. No other government agency has to do this. Private corporations don't do that either. And so this has created a huge fiscal liability for the Postal Service. So that's the primary source of financial issues at the Postal Service. And then the other issue is that anytime the economy runs into problems, the Postal Service also has issues, just like businesses across America do. So that's a more short-term issue, or, you know, that will depend on how long the economy continues to have the issues it currently does due to the COVID crisis.
Now, conservatives have used the claim of there being a fiscal crisis to make some moves against the post office. Many say they, for quite a while now, they've wanted to privatize the post office. Can you tell us a bit about that? You know, is the fiscal crisis really being used perhaps towards another purpose in terms of undermining the post office?
It absolutely is. Libertarian interests have been saying that the Postal Service would be better off as not being a government agency, of being a for-profit business since the 1970s. And the real motivation for this idea behind these libertarians who are promoting it is that they just don't like the idea of government playing a role in our lives. And they especially don't like government services that do a good job. Such as the Postal Service has been very successful now for over two centuries. So they just want to eliminate government from our lives in these ways. And they also tend to not like labor unions. And postal workers are heavily unionized, four different unions. So for these reasons, there has been this long-term push to try to get the Postal Service more and more privatized, run like a business, have things outsourced. So that is an ongoing campaign. And now, in this moment of crisis, we're seeing a sort of move towards that again. And it really is not based on the welfare of the American people, because in order to provide postal services in a universal manner, in a democratic manner, in a uniform manner to all Americans, it needs to be a government service, because a for-profit business wouldn't want to do that. Because there's lots of people who get served by our post office who don't make money for, and they would not make money for a private company. So that's why it needs to remain a government service if we want to have everyone in this nation, all Americans, continue to be served.
Yeah, and meanwhile, the Trump administration, who's goes to bat for private industry generally, including the airline industry, they got massive bailout funds in the first round of the COVID relief this spring, but the post office got none. And in fact, Donald Trump had said that if there was money for the post office in the bailout bill, that he would veto it. He wouldn't even support it. And also, Christopher Shaw, some people also see a racial aspect of this, because so many people of color, black and other people of color, have been able to move from poverty into a somewhat of a middle class life working for the post office. And now there's a lot of insecurity about what that is going to mean moving forward. Any thoughts on that, Christopher?
You're absolutely right that you know, the saying is there's always work at the post office within the black community, and these jobs have been ones that have definitely been sources of economic security and economic mobility. There just was not the same degree of employment discrimination at the post office as there was in the private sector, and so those postal jobs have been very important for social mobility, especially among black workers, and it's been that way for decades. So that is that's the reality here. Yes, I think as you just outlined it.
Right, and so you also are supporting an intriguing thing about the post office, which has to do with postal banking at the post office. Before we talk about what that could potentially look like today, can you fill our audience in a bit about the history of this? Has it had a history in the United States? And if so, why didn't it continue? Christopher Shaw.
So for most of the 20th century, Americans could walk into the post office and actually open a savings account and put their money in the bank at the post office. The post office operated a savings bank, and this existed until the 1960s. And the thing is that the banking industry never liked it, and they lobbied against it for decades. And then finally, in the 1960s, they succeeded in terminating the system. So it ends in 1966. So that's a history. There's a long history there. And when it disappeared, this definitely took away a needed service, because today we have around 9 million households that don't have bank accounts. And there are over 30,000 post offices in the country, and they're located in small, remote towns. They're located in inner-city neighborhoods. They're, you know, everywhere. And so this would provide a very effective way of having locations where people could go and have easy access and open a bank account.
Yeah, and you know, people, I suppose, living in the major cities, also sometimes we don't think of those who are living in rural areas. And some of those small towns that have been so decimated, and by the way, a number of them are in what are considered red states or red communities, where they are strong Republican supporters. And some of them say, well, the Democrats really forgot about them, or people generally forget about them. And driving through some of these towns, you could really see how communities have been devastated. A lot of the younger people leaving, stores shut down, not a lot of services, having to drive long distances to even get your mail, et cetera. So how would postal banking be a benefit? Not only for people in rural areas, but as you say, a number of people living in inner cities who right now may not have their own bank accounts. How would that work, Christopher?
One way that it's obvious that it would be a help is when the stimulus checks went out. If you didn't have a bank account, it was a lot harder for you to get these checks. And of course, these are the people who most need these funds at this time. So that's one way that it would help. Another way that it would help is if you don't have a bank account, then just simple things like cashing a paycheck become an issue. And so in order to have a bank account, you need to get a certain amount of money to have a minimum deposit, or else you're going to be hit by fees all the time. There's also a lot of hidden fees that banks charge. So for a lot of people, it actually makes more sense to just go to these check cashing outlets or a place like that, you know, even the local liquor store or something, and cash a check that way in order to actually get cash. Even though they take a sizable cut from it, at least the fee is right up front and you aren't going to get blindsided down the road. So just on that very basic level, and then beyond that, there's the whole issue of making payments for, you know, utility bills, things like that. You know, if you don't have a checking account, you don't have a way to transfer money. So it's an important issue, certainly, and it's one where the Postal Service exists to serve the American people. There's a real need here, and the Postal Service should get back into this again. The reason we aren't doing it is because the bankers don't like it. But that really isn't a good excuse.
Would postal banking help the post office in terms of its long-term sustainability and perhaps help with the fiscal crisis that it's facing due to this law that you mentioned earlier? Or would it really not be of benefit fiscally for the post office, but as you say, it certainly seems to make sense that it would greatly benefit members of the community. Christopher Shaw, your thoughts?
I think it would provide some revenues that would help sustain the Postal Service. I mean, the reason why the post office would be effective at providing these kind of banking services to people who are lower income, are not customers that banks are interested in, is because it wouldn't have the same profit motive. It wouldn't have the same incentive to get profits there. But at the same time, it would be able to generate some additional revenue. So I think it would help, help both people who would benefit from the service, and it would also help sustain the Postal Service into the future more generally. So I think in that sense, it can be a win-win.
Yeah, you know, in our next segment, we're going to be talking on about the whole issue of caregivers and children. And the reason I'm raising that is that most of the Western nations, with the exception, industrialized nations, with the exception of the United States, even across the border in Canada, they pay a family allowance or a child benefit for each child that is born. And the way it worked in the UK, it may have changed now, but the way it worked is people would get a coupon book. It was mainly the mother would get a coupon book, take the coupon to the post office, hand in the coupon, and get her money. So that's another way that the post office has been used. But just finally, your thoughts in terms of moving in this direction. Already you see the Republicans making the huge charge of socialism against the Democrats. Not that socialism is a bad thing. I mean, just ask anybody living in Western Europe, for example. But give us your final thoughts on all this, Christopher Shaw.
Well, this idea of having postal banking is now part of the national conversation. And after the campaign, the primary, the Democratic Party, the Biden side and the Senator Sanders side, they sat down and came together with some policies they agree on. And one they agreed to support now is trying to get banking back in the post office again. So this is something that the Democratic Party has signed off on. And in terms of the allegations of socialism, I'm sure that we'll hear them. But I think the important thing to point out, even to those who get scared when they hear that word, is all the benefits that are there. You know, just outline the benefits and also point out the fact that this is something that Americans did before. You know, earlier generations did this. So, you know, we can do this too. And if people continue to demand this postal banking, I think it can be realized. That's how it got to the point where now the Democratic Party is supportive of the idea, is because of public demand.
Right. And finally, are there some very specific things that people should do, or perhaps a place they can go to get more information about this idea, Christopher Shaw?
You can contact your Congress members, I think especially after the election, when depending on if we have a new administration, that would be
a great time to do that. History of postal savings is covered in my book, Money, Power, and the People, if you're interested in that. So that's a way to inform yourself, and those are actions that can be taken.
Well, Christopher Shaw, thank you so very much for taking the time to join us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Did you know that unpaid caregiving is on the rise in the United States, that there are 41 million caregivers, i.e. voters, providing the equivalent of approximately $470 billion in unpaid assistance? We're going to take a station break, and then coming up, we're going to spend the rest of the hour delving into this topic with guests Peggy O'Mara and Catherine Myers. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Women of color, girls and their mothers, ladies from all around the globe, making a stand, 'cause it's gotten out of hand, and they just want the people to know. Strike, 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 yeah, we're on a shutdown.
Eddie, and that is a strike song from the Global Women's Strike YouTube channel. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And you can also check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org, where we have a community calendar and videos, lots of other information, and our handle on Instagram and Twitter at SoTrueRadio. And we're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Nashville, Tennessee, and internationally a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the Ukraine. Now we are going to turn our attention to the whole issue of caregivers, and there's a big debate happening now in the Democratic Party, not so much a debate, actually in both parties, that are trying to see how they could garner the vote of the quote-unquote suburban housewife. And of course, by the suburban housewife, they generally mean the white suburban housewife. Now, a lot of them are mothers or part of a sandwich generation where they're caring for their children and they're also caring for elderly dependents. And Joe Biden has put forward a proposal having around the whole issue of caregivers, and there are also some proposals around tax credits and specifically in the American Family Act. And the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, they have also come out in support of a care income, which should go to people who are taking care of children, of people with disabilities, of elderly people, but also those who are caring for the environment. And family caregivers provided a collective 34 billion hours of care in 2017 to adults with limitations in their daily activities, either as a result of being elderly or related to a specific diagnosis. And the nearly $470 billion is based on an average caregiver's wage, if you were doing this, for pay, of $13.81 an hour. And unpaid caregivers' economic impact eclipses all out-of-pocket spending in United States healthcare in 2017, which was $366 billion, and the total combined value added to the U.S. economy by the agriculture, forestry, and mining sectors of $438 billion a year. So you see tremendous economic contributions by caregivers, of unpaid caregivers. That's not even combining unpaid and paid. These are unpaid caregivers, largely women that work largely falls on women, although increasingly, and a good sign that men are increasingly having to do that work. If not, it causes some issues in the household. And of course, with the COVID-19 pandemic, it has become clear to the entire world the importance of caregivers, the importance of caregiving work. And also with schools closed, people are really readily admitting that part of the purpose of school is, to educate our children, but also to provide child care so that parents could go out and do the real job, the real work, which is working outside the home for a wage. Before welcoming our guests, I'd just like to play a clip. There was a controversial series on Netflix called Mrs. America of Phyllis Schlafly and the conservative movement. And that, though, was part of the big discussion about whether mothers who are working full-time in the home should receive resources or not. There was a big debate in the early part of the women's movement. And then we'll hear a clip from the women who are going on strike, from the International Women's Strike, as they prepared for the annual March 8th strikes that happen by women around the world. Let's go to those clips now.
Please join me in welcoming Phyllis Schlafly.
They say that women are like tea bags. You don't know their strength until they get into hot water.
We need to talk about the threat of the women's liberation movement. So let me be clear. I am not against women working outside the home. That's their choice. What I am against is a small elitist group putting down homemakers. They want to create a sex-neutral society, which will mean that women are going to find themselves with two full-time jobs.
Strike is the weapon of those who work. But as women, sometimes we have to strike against work which is invisible. For example, our caring work for everyone is often invisible. And on top of that, we have to work for the market in order to survive.
Coping with disability and ill health is hard work. I'm striking to get that workload recognised and for the resources that people like us deserve.
I'm a single mother and I'm striking for welfare benefits so that single mothers have the financial right to raise children on our own if we choose to.
Women in over 40 countries will take time away from work in whatever way they can.
I'm striking because we reproduce all the people of the world and grow most of the world's food, and yet we are expected to go hungry.
I'm striking for all the mothers like me who are working to feed their kids by selling sex.
I'm striking because two women a week are killed by partners or ex-partners, and women that are suffering domestic violence are going to the authorities for help, but often their children are taken into care instead.
I am striking as a Kurdish woman because we are in the war zone. We are fighting against rape and want to get back our body, our own body.
I'm striking to end rape, destitution and detention of women and girls who are asylum seeker like me.
As a woman of colour from a mixed race family, I'm on strike against all forms of racism and Islamophobia and the effect this has on children and families.
This way, our massive social contribution will begin finally to be visible, and this will make the case for the financial compensation we have always been owed. We can demand together, internationally, a living wage for the caring work we do as mothers and as employees.
All righty, there you go. And quite a contrast there. You heard Kate Blanchett delivering the words from Phyllis Schlafly, and quite a contrast there. You heard the voice of Selma James, who is a founder of the International Wages for Housework campaign and who coined the term unwage, as well as other women speaking out. I would now like to welcome two of our guests on the line with us. I'd like to welcome Catherine Myers, Executive Director of the Family and Home Network, which helps families spend generous amounts of time together by offering affirmation, information, and advocacy. Catherine Myers, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret.
I'd also like to welcome Peggy O'Mara, independent journalist who edits and publishes PeggyO'Mara.com. She was the editor and publisher of Mothering Magazine for over 30 years. Her books include Having a Baby Naturally, Natural Family Living, The Way Back Home, and A Quiet Place. She has conducted workshops at Omega Institute, Esalon, Hollyhock, La Leche League, and Bioneers. She is the recipient of the La Leche League International 2001 Alumni Association Award, the International Peace Prayer Day 2002 Women of Peace Award, and the Holistic Moms Network 2013 Lifetime Achievement Awards, and five Maggie Awards for Public Service Journalism from the Western Publishing Association. She's the mother of four and grandmother of three. Peggy O'Mara, thank you so much for joining us.
It's wonderful to be with you, Margaret. Thank you so much. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you just fine. And Peggy, perfect. I'm sure there are lots of moms like me who, when our children, in my case, my daughter was a baby, that we just followed Mothering Magazine religiously. Because for those of us who wanted a more holistic approach, a more natural approach to childbirth, but also trying to stay away from toxins and chemicals as much as possible. So I just want to personally just make that clear to our audience, but also to thank you for all of the work that you did. And it was so helpful for those of us mothers of young children. Thank you, Peggy.
Oh, thank you so much, Margaret. It's been and was a great community of mothers before the internet, when, you know, people really needed and still need that connection as young parents to find their own way.
Absolutely. Now, Catherine Myers, tell us about, you're the executive director, tell us about Family and Home Network. Why this network and what you are aiming to do? Catherine.
Sure, thank you. The organization was founded by three at-home mothers in 1984, and it was originally named Mothers at Home. We changed the name of the organization in the year 2000 to embrace mothers working part-time and fathers at home, and to be to make the point, really, that you can't simply divide mothers into two categories, at home or at work. Mothers move in and out of the workforce during their life course. And at the same time, our tagline is that we support, you know, we work to help parents spend generous amounts of time with their children. And we think that's very important. That's shown by developmental science to be important. And the early relationships with infants and young children. And we want parents to make their own decisions. We want parents to be informed about the choices, and we want them to be supported in all choices. So we speak out against policies that are not inclusive, policies that are designed only for certain families. And unfortunately, that's still being done with a focus on working families. That term is not defined very well, and it's not inclusive of all families. So we want to see policies like the American Family Act that just simply apply to all families. It really makes life more, it opens up possibilities for families. It makes gives parents more flexibility and more choice and more respect for the caregiving work and income earning work that they do, however they meet those responsibilities.
Right. And, you know, Peggy O'Mara, following up on what Catherine has said, when, you know, the term working families, I mean, I, as you know, I have been part of the movement, really, of calling for valuation and a living wage for caregivers, et cetera, and also for work to be redefined, because right now when people think of work or workers, they think of, well, going out to work, work outside the home. But any mother or caregiver, even father now, who's stuck at home with the children due to COVID, can tell you that it's some of the hardest work there is. And I wondered if you could just weigh in on that, on that particular point. And secondly, on the whole early kind of divide in the women's movement, a little known fact is that I, in fact, debated Phyllis Schlafly. I think it was CBS in Baltimore or something that did a series, a couple of cities, I think we did, and then they did a poll of the audience to find out. I was making the case for wages for housework. Schlafly, of course, was going off against the ER, whatever trip she was on. And interestingly enough, our side, Peggy, won all of those, even though I was seen as, you know, I suppose they invited me because I was this radical, right, promoting something like wages for housework. So I just wondered if you would tackle that a bit, this whole concept of what is work, but also the way that focusing on caregiving work is a path to unity, actually, across the spectrum. Your thoughts, Peggy O'Mara.
I love that. I think I'm very, like you, I'm very encouraged by the conversation about caregiving, that the pandemic has forced us to look at, and, you know, so many people have experienced the, not only the importance of that, but the complexity of it, you know, that mothers are, and parents are always working, and so much of the work that mothers and parents do is well, you know, none of it is paid for. And how do we value that? I mean, even when we talk about caregiving now, like in Joe Biden's plan, you know, he offers great assistance for those who want child care assistance. But what about those who are caring for their children at home, who really value that work, or who want to breastfeed according to the World Health Organization and the Academy of Pediatrics recommendations, who want to breastfeed exclusively for 6 months? Those women know that if they go back to work, they will reduce the duration of their breastfeeding, and they will not meet their goals that they have for their family. So what is work is, you know, we know as mothers, we're always working, always doing all kinds of things. And as Kathy said, women in general are moving in and out of the workforce. Sometimes they're working, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're caring for their children. In fact, most of them say that working full-time is not ideal. Only about 45% of women feel that part-time work is ideal, and 19% say not working at all is ideal when they have young children. I would like to see us take this conversation about caregiving and include stay-at-home parents with this, parents who are working, staying at home by choice, caring for their children. They don't seem to be included in Biden's plan. He talks about a lot of tax credits, which are very important. But as Kathy mentioned, the American Family Act really has the best example of tax credits that really help families and that reduce poverty, because we're not, you know, what we need, what we're seeing now in the pandemic is a huge increase in poverty and a potentially biggest increase in 25 years. So we need to also be addressing poverty and all children and all families when we're talking about what we can do to support families. The child allowance is one of the most successful things. It was 1 year version of the American Family Act was included in the HEROES Act, which was recently passed by the House of Representatives. But according to a recent report from the Century Foundation, a robust child allowance would slash poverty by 42%, lifting over 4 million children out of poverty and reducing poverty among Black children by more than half. We've got lots of examples in the United States, lots of examples all over the world of the effectiveness of child credits, family credits, child allowances. A few years ago, Canada increased its maximum payment to about $4,800 per year in American dollars and quickly reduced child poverty by over a third. So, as you said earlier on, Margaret, you know, we're the only country that doesn't support families, and that, you know, we've just got to start supporting families, and all families, not just families who are working families, not just for the purpose of getting women into the workforce. We've got to appreciate the unpaid caregiving that mothers do all the time and figure out a way to support that. And I think we have some momentum toward looking at the importance of child allowances and child credits to do that.
Right, I couldn't agree more. And Catherine Myers, back to you. The Biden plan, by the way, the Biden-Harris plan, includes support for what they're calling informal caregivers, and I imagine that is unpaid caregivers, family members or loved ones who do this work unpaid, and it includes a $5,000 refundable tax credit for informal caregivers. It includes Social Security credits for people who care for their loved ones and professional and peer support for caregivers of wounded, injured, or ill active duty service members and veterans. So, you know, it has, the discussion at least has reached that level, yeah. Although, as Peggy says, the American Family Act goes a lot further than this. But so your thoughts on that Biden plan, and also tell us why you think the AFA or the American Family Act is a bit stronger than what Biden is putting forward. Catherine Myers.
Sure. Well, I have some questions about the Biden plan. Peggy and I have looked at that, and wasn't really clear to us the $5,000 per year, whether that was intended to go only to people who are caring for elders or also to parents caring for young children. So that's something that we're just puzzled by. You know, it's not written in legislation yet. It's a plan on his website, and it's a little hard to see that. It puts a lot of money into child care systems, and Family and Home Network thinks that it's wrong to put money into a system of care that serves some families without an equivalent effort and money being spent on supporting parents who are doing the exact same work and raising right. children. And so that's for us a problem with the Biden child care plan, that they don't, I actually didn't even see the word mothers in there or anything about at-home parents. It's kind of a little bit of an awkward term to call at-home parents, because we want to acknowledge the work done by parents without putting people in categories of yeah. work, without defining them by the type of work that they do outside the home.
What about the American Family Act?
The American Family Act is a different approach. It's taking the child tax credit and making it fully refundable, so that the people who earn the least will be able to get the full amount of the credit. And that's not true currently. So that's how it raises more families out of poverty. And that's a really important thing. And it makes it paid monthly, so that families don't have to wait until they file taxes, and they get a payment every month. It's like a child allowance. It's called a child tax credit, but it's essentially the same as a child allowance. And it would support parents while they're struggling to raise their children and pay the cost either of time away from work or the cost of paying someone else to care for the child. It would give the parents choice about what to do. We're very happy to see that many of the people who were candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination are co-sponsors of the American Family Act. There's 30 in the Senate. there's a lot of co-sponsors in the House, and there's 37 senators who are who co-sponsored it, including Kamala Harris and Amy Klobuchar and Cory Booker. But I was surprised to see that Joe Biden did not sponsor that, and I hope that that he will show his support for that bill that would put money into parents' hands and let them decide how to care for their young children.
Right, and Peggy O'Mara, back to you for a moment there. Peggy O'Mara, of course, known for the publication of Mothering Magazine for over three decades. We have just about 4.5 minutes or so left, Peggy, but I do want you to weigh in on this. It does seem as though you know, some politicians give lip service to caregiving work. For example, President Obama, when he was a candidate, famously said that single mothers are some of the hardest working people, something like that. That's not an exact quote, something along those lines. And then when the Democrats criticize the Republican candidate for saying his wife hadn't worked a day in his life, I think it was Mitt Romney, was it not, that said, "Well, know, she's the mother of five," or she said, goodness, "I'm the mother of five." So it does seem as though there really is still, even on the progressive side, organized labor, et cetera, really have difficulty with this concept of caregivers and caregivers being workers. But what COVID has exposed is that unwaged caregivers are not only workers doing essential work of keeping families and whole communities together, but they are essential workers, right? So what impact do you think it would have? And again, looking at the fight for the vote of the suburban housewife, what impact do you think it would have if on all of the parties would really focus on this issue more and say very clearly what they intend to do about it? Peggy O'Mara.
Well, I mean, I think they're afraid to talk about it. You know, you don't hear people mention mothers anymore. We're afraid to talk about the work of mothers, to praise the work of mothers. We still want to talk about caregivers, while most of the caregiving is done by women and mothers. So I think it's important that we elevate the position of mothers and tell the truth about the work that mothers and caregivers do. Let's look at the example of a single mother that I know. She lost her job because of COVID. She was laid off because of COVID because the place she was working for shut down. She applied for unemployment. She got this extra $600 that changed her life. She finally actually was making almost, I mean, beyond a minimum wage, finally a working wage, and it changed her life. Now, when she starts to apply for a job, now she doesn't get that anymore, you know, because as you said, Senate's on vacation, Congress has dropped the whole conversation about the renewing the unemployment benefits or addressing people's evictions or what the heck people are going to do. So she is now, as an unemployed mother on unemployment, applying for five jobs a week, going to interviews, but nobody can give her the flexibility she needs to now teach her child at home as well. So we're not digging down deeply to talk about the real felt experience of what is happening with parents at home, with mothers at home, with single mothers at home. If, you know, I want the parties to talk about what they're really going to do, but I want them to drop this prejudice about low-income people, drop this prejudice against mothers at home, and as Kathy says, support all families to care for their families, to do what they need to do to care for their families, and to, you know, get this, to think about the child. You know, this debate about whether you're a mother at home or you're doing whatever, you know, there's a child involved. And we know when we lift children out of poverty that they do better at school, they have less problems and mental health problems, they get more education, that it betters our society if we take care of all members of our society.
Right. And on that note, I just looked at the clock. Catherine, I'm terribly sorry because we are out of time. But you know what? Okay. We'll need to have both of you back because we haven't dug as deep as clearly we know this topic absolutely deserves. So we appreciate you joining us. And Peggy, absolutely right. Of the 140 million poor or close to poor people in the United States, close to over 70% of them are women and children. So this is a vital topic also when we're dealing with the issue of race and racism. Yeah. A hint to my friends there in Black Lives Matter. So Peggy O'Mara, Catherine Myers, we'll have you both back. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's wonderful to talk to you. Thank you, Margaret.
All righty. We're out of time. I'd like to thank our audio engineer, Lizette Tapia, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you like a copy of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archive. Thank you for listening. And y'all, please stay safe. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
I ain't gonna do you wrong. Why you gone? I ain't gonna do you wrong. 'Cause I
to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Reclaim, a community panel on land and housing on Saturday, August 29th from 3 to 5 p.m., streaming